You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Today's podcast is on cyclical Cushing's syndrome. In it, Dr. Blevins discusses his experiences and challenges with the condition. Dr. Blevins also reviews the results and findings of a cyclical Cushing syndrome survey we recently conducted on Pituitary World News.
Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting to you from beautiful Sausalito on a fine, sunny Friday afternoon in December. Today, I want to talk about the cyclical Cushing survey that we conducted recently at Pituitary World News. I'll start by saying that we had 200 people access the survey, 100 started the survey, and only 37 completed the study. We obviously don't understand the reasons why there was a low completion rate, but the results are interesting enough to discuss during this podcast. Before we do so, however, let's talk about what we already know about cyclical Cushing syndrome from the literature. It was in the mid-1950s that a patient who had periodic or cyclical Cushing's with fluctuating symptoms was first reported, and they noted that the patient had worsening symptoms and signs about every 10 days. In the 1970s, there was a second case reported that seemed to fit the criteria for cyclical Cushing's. And then in 1985, Brew Atkinson from Belfast published a series of patients that had fairly regular episodic hypercortisolism. Subsequently, in different publications from Dr. Atkinson and others, the definition of cyclical Cushing syndrome, where there's true cyclicity, has been based on the finding of three peaks and two troughs of cortisol hypersecretion. Peaks meaning levels when cortisol levels are high, troughs meaning when levels are low or lower than the highs. If you look at the studies that have been reported in the literature, the cyclicity varies from every 12 hours to every 85 days. The classic firm definition is that these cycles are regular, regularly occurring, just like a sine wave or a cosine wave. However, some have suggested that there may be some irregularity to the cycles as well in patients who truly have cyclical Cushing syndrome. Unfortunately, in this illness, the data have been muddied by studies of what I think of as intermittent hypercortisolism. We know that in patients with Cushing syndrome, regardless of the cause, that these tumors can release hormones in pulses or bursts, and that can lead to some intermittent evidence of secretion. And to me, that's a different disorder than patients who have true cyclical Cushing syndrome. We'll talk more about that later. One of the most important things you need to understand is that the pathophysiology, or in other words, what's going on behind the cyclicity, is really not known. There's been a lot of speculation over secretion of hormones or other hormones regulating hormone production by the tumors, for example. We do know that of patients with documented cyclical Cushing syndrome, let's say if you took 100 people with documented cyclical Cushing syndrome, 54% of them have pituitary tumors, 26% have ectopic ACTH, 11% have adrenal tumors. That's not to say that 54% of people with Cushing's disease have cyclical Cushing syndrome. What it is saying is that of all people with cyclical Cushing's, most of them have pituitary adenomas, but some of them have other tumors as well. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, to know that cyclical Cushing's can occur from any tumor that ultimately results in excessive cortisol secretion. There have been a couple of studies looking at the incidence of cyclical hypercortisolism in patients with Cushing's disease, and some of those papers estimate about 17 to 19% of people with Cushing's disease will have evidence of cyclical hypercortisolism. Now, what we don't gain from those papers is how severe the Cushing's is in those patients and whether or not those patients were readily diagnosed. My guess is that these are patients with documented severe Cushing's, readily identifiable disease, who underwent testing and had the cyclicity demonstrated in nearly 20% of patients. In most of the studies that have looked at Cushing's disease of a cyclical nature, a majority, 95% of patients have had evidence for Cushing syndrome on exam with at least one or more of the hard clinical features of Cushing syndrome. As physicians, we consider those hard clinical features as unexplained osteoporosis, easy bruising, thinning of the skin, central weight redistribution, and cervicodorsal fat pad thickening. Plethora is another one that can go along with this, but I see lots of patients with plethora or redness of the face due to other reasons as well. Some of the other things we see in Cushing's include hypertension, diabetes, hirsutism, irregular menses, depression, and so on. And these symptoms and signs are seen in patients with all sorts of different conditions, including metabolic syndrome, polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a variant of metabolic syndrome, depression, alcoholism, for example. So this podcast is not meant to go through the different diagnostic tests for hypercortisolism, because I think that Cushing syndrome still needs to be proved with traditional classic testing. Obviously, patients who have marked hypercortisolism have been exposed to too much cortisol for their body. So most but not all will have high cortisol levels. Most but not all will fail to suppress with dexamethasone. All will usually have an abnormal diurnal variation in cortisol secretion. So I think that it's important to recognize that if you have Cushingoid symptoms and it's due to Cushing's, usually you're going to have abnormal laboratory tests. I have seen an overutilization of certain tests, such as the salivary cortisol, as a diagnostic test for Cushing syndrome, when in truth the test is designed to be a screening test for Cushing's. Screening tests are designed to identify people who may have a disease, but you're going to have people who have false abnormalities and really truly don't have the disease process. Another test that's been touted is the early morning 8 hours of urine collection, urinary cortisol to creatinine ratio. This does tend to correlate with 24-hour urine cortisol levels because it's looking at a third of the day, and it's looking at a day when most of us have low cortisol levels starting at the time of the collection, or the time the urine would be stored in the bladder. But cortisol levels are rising in the morning, and people who have stress and a robust HPA axis might actually have elevated values. But this is a test. It's not a diagnostic test. It's a screening test. And unfortunately, I've seen it used as a diagnostic test by some physicians. I think both these tests, the salivary cortisol test and the early morning 8-hour urine cortisol to creatinine ratio, are good for following patients who might have cyclical Cushing's, so that you can see the pattern of cortisol secretion. But again, I caution against using these as diagnostic tests and saying that you have cyclical Cushing's because you had an elevated urine cortisol to creatinine ratio in your early morning urine. Unfortunately, physicians are using these tests, and I have seen a lot of patients who come to me who have had 100 tests, and maybe they had 2 salivary cortisols out of 20 that were abnormal, and 2 early morning urine cortisol levels that were abnormal out of 15 or 20 different samples, and they've been diagnosed with Cushing syndrome, and even cyclical Cushing syndrome, when there's no real true evidence in some cases that they have any hard features of hypercortisolism, and certainly no pituitary tumors on MRI or no tumors elsewhere either. So with all of that said, I think these studies are useful to follow people who you think might have cyclical Cushing syndrome, but be careful using these as diagnostic tests. You have to have more than just a couple of abnormal tests. Just the nature of dynamic and physiologic testing is that if you test something enough, you're going to find some abnormal results that aren't really truly meaningful. So I recommend caution in making a diagnosis based on some of these tests that aren't proved to be dynamic tests, but instead are truly screening tests. The other point I sort of alluded to earlier that I want to make here again is that some people truly have cyclical Cushing syndrome, some have intermittent Cushing syndrome, and others have persistent Cushing syndrome. Is there a spectrum? Do some people start out with intermittent or cyclical and become more full-blown? That certainly is suggested by the literature, but also by some of the survey responses that we've had, where a number of you indicated that you started out with minimal symptoms and signs and perhaps some normal results mixed with abnormal results, thought to have cyclical Cushing's, but then later had persistent Cushing syndrome. So perhaps in the early stages of the disease, there is some cyclicity, and maybe that is where the investigators who talked about 17 to 19% of patients with Cushing's disease having cyclicity, maybe they were seeing the patients who had normal cortisol dynamics for a small tumor or early in the disease process. So this is a good time to remind you about a patient that I've discussed here before. It's the best case of cyclical Cushing syndrome that I have seen. And it was a lady who had severe marked hypercortisolemic features, came to see me, clearly had Cushing syndrome, had an ACTH level that was elevated, urine cortisol levels that were elevated, but a negative MRI. And not knowing whether she had ectopic ACTH or pituitary tumor, I sent her for petrosal sinus sampling. And when the study was done, her serum cortisols were undetectable. Her ACTH levels were 5 or less. And the test was basically worthless. One of the things you need to keep in mind is that an inferior petrosal sinus sampling must be done when a patient has hypercortisolism or the results are essentially invalid. One cannot interpret them. One cannot determine whether the central to peripheral gradient is real or not, because normal people have a central to peripheral gradient. So you have to be hypercortisolemic to be able to get an idea of whether IPSS can prove there's a pituitary tumor or an ectopic ACTH secreting tumor. I've seen a number of physicians try to use IPSS as a diagnostic test for Cushing's, but it's not. You can only do the test if a patient's hypercortisolemic, and then you can only then make an assessment as to whether the patient has central or peripheral ACTH secretion. And this is really important because the data I showed you earlier said that 54% of patients with cyclical Cushing's have pituitary tumors, 26% ectopic ACTH, 11% adrenal tumors. So you really cannot use the test unless the patient's hypercortisolemic. It is important to do it to try to identify the source. But if you're not hypercortisolemic, you may see ACTH secretion from the normal pituitary mimicking a pituitary tumor when there's no tumor there whatsoever. And in these patients, usually where there's no tumor seen on MRI, that leads to errors in the prescription of transsphenoidal surgery for patients. At any rate, back to my patient. So I sent her home. No treatment was necessary. We actually treated her with a little bit of a low dose of steroids, but no treatment for the Cushing's was necessary. And over the course of a few weeks, she had marked improvement in symptoms and signs. Only 2, and I can't remember if it was 4 months or 6 months later, had another episode of marked and severe, rapidly progressive symptoms and signs with elevated urine cortisols. We sent her to petrosal sinus sampling again, and again, her levels were low. So we watched her again another 4 to 6 months later, had severe recurrence, and at that time I elected to simply do bilateral adrenalectomy to treat her hypercortisolism because still we were seeing nothing on her MRI. It was about a year and a half or two later that she presented with a 1 centimeter pituitary adenoma, underwent surgery, and had an ACTH-producing pituitary tumor. So clearly she had cyclical Cushing syndrome and well-defined periods of cortisol hypersecretion. And it was due to a small microscopic pituitary tumor below the limits of resolution of the MRI, and I had no convincing data on which to determine whether she had pituitary or ectopic ACTH secretion, and that's why she had the adrenalectomy, and then with time she demonstrated that she had a pituitary adenoma and was successfully treated with that, with surgery for that particular problem. Her case is classic. She had hypercortisolism, marked Cushingoid features, and it's different and distinct from a lot of the cases that I have been referred with possible cyclical Cushing syndrome of late, who really have minimal clinical symptoms and signs, or variable clinical symptoms and signs, and normal cortisol levels. And that is a diagnostic challenge for us physicians, because we don't know whom amongst those group of patients has early mild Cushing's, and who has something else that's yet to be determined or described to identify what's going on in similarly affected patients. It is conceivable that that's the early stage of the disease, that there will be cyclical cortisol secretion until the tumor gets large enough to override whatever process is driving this cyclicity. So I don't want to discount the fact that some patients may have early disease. I think the error is where people with mild symptoms and signs, or moderate symptoms and signs even, who are looking for a diagnosis, who have mostly normal laboratory studies, going to transphenoidal pituitary surgery for exploration with no real clear evidence where the tumor is located. Because certainly the Cushing syndrome, even though it can be very problematic, if it's mild, there's nothing wrong with trying a low dose of ketoconazole to try to see if the patient improves when you lower cortisol production, or giving a tincture of thyme so that you can see whether disease progresses or whether a tumor demonstrates itself. And I think what happens is that people get in a hurry for a solution or a therapeutic solution, that they jump to transphenoidal surgery when a tincture of thyme is probably the best approach in some patients. All right, that's the editorial. As you see, I firmly believe in cyclical Cushing syndrome. I've seen it. I've read the papers. It's out there. I'm open-minded about the fact that this may exist in some patients with mild disease, but certainly patients can have severe disease and have cyclicity. I don't know what to say or do about those patients with mostly negative testing who have occasional elevations in salivary cortisol or first morning urine cortisol, but no clinical symptoms or signs or pituitary tumors, but I caution against proceeding straight to surgery without some more definitive evidence of cyclical Cushing syndrome or hypercortisolism that warrants the risks and expense of transphenoidal surgery and other testing or treatments, for example. Okay, let's go to the results of the survey. A couple of interesting things. Most patients had experienced symptoms and signs for less than 10 years. About one-third of you had symptoms and signs for more than 10 years. The next biggest group was probably 14% who had symptoms for 5 years, 12% who had symptoms for 2 years, and the rest of it was pretty much evenly distributed around the pie chart. We asked respondents whether a definite pituitary tumor was seen on MRI, and it was seen in 72% of patients, so they clearly had an adenoma documented. Almost 28% of patients did not have a definite pituitary tumor. Just over three quarters of you underwent pituitary surgery. One quarter did not. Three quarters of you had, let's say 70% of you had a pituitary tumor proved at surgery. One third did not. Interestingly, of those patients who had a tumor, symptoms and signs resolved in a very small proportion of people, as far as I'm concerned, of only about 40%. Usually those who have true Cushing's and an ACTH-producing tumor, the symptoms and signs and the disease process improves in nearly all patients. There are studies about Cushing syndrome with lingering effects out there that I won't go into at this time, but maybe a later podcast. So it's not a surprise that not everyone got better, but I would have thought those who had a tumor documented at surgery would have had improvement in symptoms and signs. But interestingly, in those who had surgery with no tumor found, an overwhelming majority, 86%, had no improvement in symptoms and signs. So it leads me to wonder, did they have a tumor elsewhere? Was a tumor left in the pituitary? Did they have a tumor at all? Those are the things that a physician who has to practice using scientific theories would ask those types of questions. About half the patients had medical therapy to improve symptoms and signs before surgery, and a majority of people actually had no improvement in symptoms and signs on medical therapy. When I see data like that, it makes me wonder, was the drug therapy appropriate? Did they use the right doses? Did they push the doses high enough? Or did the patient have Cushing's in the first place? Because usually you can take a patient with documented Cushing's and treat them with medical therapy and they will improve their symptoms and signs. So some of the things that I found most interesting about this survey were the responses to some of the open-ended questions. And the responses are too numerous to go over in this podcast. And yet at the same time do sort of lend some credence to some of the things that I have said already about cyclical Cushing syndrome and things that we as physicians need to consider. So I think this was very valuable to have asked these questions to these people who self-identify themselves as having cyclical Cushing's. And the first question was, how cyclical was your disorder? Some people really weren't sure because physicians hadn't done the testing, but they had done enough testing to sort of figure that out. Some people knew that they fluctuated every 2 weeks. Some said that they fluctuated every 3 to 4 days and sometimes 3 to 4 months. Others said it was very variable and even had episodes of spontaneous tanning prior to the diagnosis. One noted that the cyclicity increased in frequency as the Cushing's became more severe. So that was very interesting. Several noticed that early on they had cyclical Cushing's and then it became more persistent. And I think that probably does speak to the fact that a number of patients with this particular disorder probably do have early disease characterized by cyclicity or an intermittent nature of cortisol secretion. Then as the disease worsens, it becomes more persistent. These responses and those contentions may sort of lend credence to the notion of a tincture of time may be required before submitting oneself to transsphenoidal pituitary surgery to get a diagnosis. I know it's very frustrating to have this disorder, and my heart goes out to those of you who suffer with Cushing syndrome and suffer with the symptoms and signs, and I do understand the need to get a quick diagnosis and treatment, but sometimes it's best to err on the side of watchful waiting than rushing off to the operating room before a diagnosis is secured. We asked the question, how is the cyclical nature proved? And in most situations, it was different laboratory tests, urine and salivary cortisols, 24-hour urine cortisols, early morning cortisol ratios, etc. So there's really nothing new or useful there other than the fact that a lot of testing is sometimes necessary to prove the cyclical nature of the disease process and to confirm the diagnosis. One patient reported having over 160 tests to get the diagnosis of Cushing's and cyclical Cushing's. Many patients talked about having cyclical symptoms that correlated with laboratory studies. We asked the question, what was your highest 24-hour urine cortisol? And the results were all over. Some people had high normal levels. Other people had frank marked hypercortisolism. One documented a cortisol level of 1,800. Some had high normal levels, and I've certainly seen people with documented Cushing's with high normal levels. The philosophy there, the theory is that when we look at a cortisol assay, there's a reference range or a normal range, and I think for urine cortisol, most places now it's 5 to 50. And the thing is that everybody has their own normal set points for cortisol secretion and would have their own little normal range or normal distribution in normal settings. Obviously, if you're under stress, the cortisol level is going to be much higher. But we usually have our own little normal range if we're not stressed out. So if your normal cortisol is supposed to be 20, and let's say 20 plus or minus 5, so you know maybe 15 to 25, and that's where you usually sit, but you have a tumor that drives cortisol production upwards and it's early in the disease state and your cortisol levels are 45, 47, those are double what your body is supposed to have, and you will probably have Cushingoid symptoms and signs there. So this is why we don't discount the result that a normal cortisol result should not be taken as exclusive of the diagnosis, and that's why we do dynamic studies and salivary cortisol profiles and dexamethasone suppressed CRH stimulation tests, etc. We asked questions about medications used and what was the experience, and it appears that most of those who did try medication tried ketoconazole. As expected, some people didn't tolerate the medication. Some people improved in symptoms and signs, but others did not. Metirapone was also tried. Some people tried dopamine agonist drugs. Others tried mifepristone or Korlym. So to me, this survey was very useful. It certainly required me to think in detail about symptoms and signs of hypercortisolism and cyclical Cushing syndrome. I did a little research in the literature to try to understand more what types of articles are being published out there and the robustness with which the diagnosis has been made by those who are writing about this particular topic. So I learned a lot, and I hope that you have as well. If I could leave you with one thing, it would be that Cushing syndrome is a very dangerous, life-threatening, potentially fatal disorder. And so are the therapies. So be sure that you're working with your physicians to secure a diagnosis. Be patient. Take your time. Be willing to seek out second opinions. And most of all, share your experiences so all of us can learn more about this intriguing disorder that we call cyclical Cushing syndrome, that may be several disorders rolled into one, including early traditional Cushing's or intermittent Cushing's, or whatever you want to call it. But share your experiences with us here at Pituitary World News so that we can learn more and teach our trainees and share with our colleagues so that we can all get a better handle on this intriguing diagnosis. Once again, Dr. Lewis Blevins at Pituitary World News. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good day.
Please send your comments and questions to pituitaryworldnews.org. And don't forget to subscribe to our articles and podcasts. Thank you for listening.